people when I walked in were like, oh, we're so excited you're talking today. And I'm like, I am not. I think it'd be okay if no one was here today. My family sat in the front row in case people rushed the stage for good or bad reasons. That's why my oh-so-supportive families. Dave and I were talking before, and we're like, gosh, it feels like a lot of pressure. But yet, when Brian asked me last Sunday if I could speak today on uncertainty, even though I had 1,000 things going on this week, I said yes, because I had already been thinking about things to say before Brian asked me to talk. And I said, Brian, one of the things on my mind so much lately is how much I wish I could be certain. I wish that I could be much more like my family who are, well, I have two families, I'll back up. My first family is evangelical in nature. My grandfather was a Presbyterian pastor. My father is a Presbyterian pastor, has his doctorate, highly educated, and then everything kind of went nutty and people went Assembly of God, and so they're like super emotional at church. So the rest of them out because nice, calm, Methodist, Lutheran, Presbyterian is good for me. But they are so sure of their faith. They are so sure of how their faith ties into their politics. And then I'm on the other side where I just don't see it at all. I don't often feel sure of anything in life. I have lived my whole uncertain life surrounded by people who are very certain of their faith. That's what it feels like, and then I'm always the odd dog out. In confirmation class, they were talking about God and the things you talk about in confirmation class. I was the one who said, well, what if there is no God? I'm like, what if it's not God? When your dad is the one teaching the class, it makes you cranky, you know, and he's probably just going to shut you down. And so that's what happened. You just kind of get shut down. And this is what you believe, and because the Bible says so. I just have never been very good at that. And as an adult, I'm still not. I'm still seeking certainty in a very, very uncertain world. I wonder where God is during things like a genocide. Because I follow Humans of New York. Has anyone else been reading The Rwandan? Are you just in tears waiting for sections 3, 4, 5 of 7? And you're reading about horrific things and people who stopped killing by 3 p.m. because they were tired. And you just think, how can this be? And you're scared about our own country. And are there any parallels? Are things being built that are frightening? But woven into that story of Humans of New York and the people in Rwanda dealing with the worst atrocities we cannot even imagine. Even though the words are there, the pictures are there, we cannot even imagine, are the people of God. The man from the orphanage from yesterday, who risked his life to save all those people, hiding people in a ceiling, who went out. He went to a radio station when he was called to go because he didn't know what else to do. And because he was brave and he had faith, he saved the people that God gave him responsibility for. That's where God is. So for myself, when I am uncertain, I am thankful that I can recognize certainty and trust in the people that I know and trust, or the stories that I read and hear. I can see the hand of God in so many areas of my life. I can see the hand of God in me being here at Imago, because before we moved here, and I've told this story many times, before we moved here, I was searching for every single church in the Peoria area, because I knew that if we were going to successfully make a move, we would have to have a community. And that's
going to be church for us. For some people, it's sports or a bar. At one point in my life, it was definitely the bar. But at this stage of my life, it's not. I searched, I read the website of every church in the area, and I found Imago, and I liked what it said on the website. So whoever does the website, sorry, because we're stuck here now, and we're probably not going anywhere. It's the way it is. So I see the hand of God, and who made that website, who had the words that I needed to see. It wasn't perfect, but there were the important ones to me. I see God in that. I have four sisters, all of whom are quite certain of their faith. Again, that's in two different families. It has never occurred to them to question a seven-day creation story or dinosaurs or how that works. My first mother believes she can tell if people are saved or not by looking at them, and Democrats definitely are not. I've been a Democrat probably since I was born because I'm the black sheep. My little sister used to tell the mean kids at school that they couldn't hurt her because there were angels surrounding her, and I just thought she was crazy. So for me, this uncertainty goes all the way back. I never understood, but for my sisters, their certainty goes all the way back. My second mother didn't know that she could even have an opinion about anything until she was in college. And I was probably a shock to her system because I have an opinion about everything. We have some great discussions about faith, but we're at a stalemate when it comes to communion because she's Missouri Synod Lutheran, which, if you're not familiar, is very similar to Catholic in style of worship as far as very sedate and very calm. So there, we have great discussions about faith because they don't believe you can have communion if you don't talk to the pastor or you're not a member of the church. And I wholeheartedly disagree. There's so much in me that wishes I could agree and not argue. There's so much in me that wishes I could agree with my other three sisters and my birth family and just fit into the puzzle of who they are. I was not created for that because I have been this way since the day I was born. And some of you have too. And it's really hard to always be the puzzle piece that doesn't fit. But yet, you don't fit in those areas. That doesn't mean you don't fit. You might just be trying to fit into the wrong puzzle. I wish I could accept a literal interpretation of the Bible. I wish I could read some verse and not think about the cultural times, the translation differences, the deeper implications, things like metaphors and similes and all of the things that I've learned. I wish I could begin to understand any of that. I think it would feel so much more solid and safer. When I was 14, I went to live with a different family. I've spent very little time with my biological family since then. And I spent a great deal of my life trying to create my own family because I didn't fit in the first one. And in the second one, I wasn't sure if I fit either. I've always searched for people to depend on and people to trust, a place to belong. When you don't have a dad who can show up when your car breaks down or a mom you can call when it's a bad day, well, you could call her, but you'll regret it. You compensate in a lot of ways. Some people learn to change their own tires. I just kept trying to create family. And everybody I dated, I might not like the guy, but I liked the kids. So I'd try to create my own family. Or my friend's family, I would go to all their holiday things, anything they invited me to, and just try to pretend like maybe if you don't notice me, I'll be like your kid. And it was when I had my own kids that I absolutely stopped doing that because I could not subject my children to what I had been through. I will never let them be in a place where they are less than whole in anyone's eyes. They will always be a full grandchild, a full nephew, not just somebody's kid. I've spent much of my life focused on what I didn't have, and I missed along the way the things I did have. When I what I used to call my second family used to be my foster family. I only lived with them for a year and a half, and I often have said I felt like the Velveteen Rabbit, if you're familiar with the book. The Velveteen Rabbit just wanted to be loved enough to be real. And that was my correlation. I wanted to be loved enough to be real. And that's very sad. I wanted to fit, to be loved enough, to be an unquestioned part of a safe family and to feel certain. And here's the problem for them, I was. I didn't understand in my second family that love shows up in so many different ways. That every time my foster father told me, drive carefully, he said, I love you. That every time my mom would call, my foster mom, she didn't have the right words because she's Norwegian and she doesn't have a lot of words. She doesn't know how to have a strong opinion. She's getting better because I am teaching her things, but, she still loved me and they carved out a place for me to fit. But I spent years of my life thinking I didn't fit. I wasn't real because that's what was in my head. And I missed all the times, all the places that they had created a space that was Diane-sized because I didn't show up because I was still convinced I didn't fit. When I went home to my foster family to visit when Sam was born, because I wanted my mom to be his grandma, and I wanted to ask her that, I was surprised and stunned when my sister introduced me to her neighbor as her sister Diane. There was no uncertainty for her. She didn't say foster. There was no clarifiers. There was no somebody who used to live with me. I was her sister. And her neighbor was so excited to meet me because she has heard so much about me, which should be concerning. Because not all those stories are good ones. And that was a complete revelation to me that she had been talking about me all these years. And I wonder if Jesus and God are like that. I wonder if the God that I do not understand and am so often quite unsure of is actually quite sure of me. He made me to be the way I am. He found a place for me to fit. He set me on a path to be able to understand intimately the journeys of people who've had difficult journeys and to not at all understand people who've had beaver cleaver lives, because I don't understand. But they don't need me as much as the people who've had not typical journeys do. Jesus has told God all about me. While Dave and Monica were singing, it came to me so clearly. You did such a good job. So clearly that one of the cracks in my faith is trust. That so many people who spoke in the name of God in my life spoke incorrectly. And they were mean, and they were not safe, and they were unkind. And because they spoke in the name of God, then I didn't trust God. Sometimes don't trust God. But they didn't have the right to speak for God. And the small, quiet voice of God speaks when he sends my foster mom, when he has my sister introduce me as her sister Diane, when he gives me all three of my children through very unique ways, when he brings me to a church full of people who have questions too. When I find out about something called the Hot Mess Sisters, and then a year later, I end up being one of the managers of the Hot Mess Sisters, because if you talk about something a lot here and say you really like it, it's a dangerous thing. But yet, your life will be better. Your life will be better for it. So in the midst of all the uncertainty of my life, there are some things I am certain of. I am certain that faith, which has been taken out and studied and questioned and held and stretched and argued about, is stronger, just like a muscle, than faith that never had any stretching. I'm certain that I'm a little lazy, and I don't really like doing that work. I would rather have things nice and simple. I would rather just stand up here and make a bunch of jokes and have you laugh. I don't know if it's because I'm a seven, but I definitely prefer joy to deep levels of introspection. I'm certain that you can't be angry at something that doesn't exist. Anger is from hurt and disappointment. So when you wonder if God, where was God in all of that, I don't have your answer. But somewhere there was God working in someone. I'm certain that I was designed to be exactly who I am, as I am. That here at Imago, this is the first time in my life that I have ever truly understood and valued that and felt valued for that. I am certain that I understand who Jesus championed and cared about. I'm certain that that is clear. I am positive that love wins over and over. After all hope seems lost, love wins. Love has a cost and often requires a lot of humility, and there will be pain, but it still wins. I'm certain that God has a sense of humor. It is the only possible explanation for so very many things in the world. Most intimately to me is that when I was a kid, I liked to read Nancy Drew, play with Barbie dolls, and make my little sister like play school, and I was the teacher because I was going to tell her what to do. And I have two boys who don't do those things, and they think farting and pooping are really funny, and Sam is very much into... He'll come out of the bathroom and say, "Holy Hannah, Mom, you gotta see this." And I'm like, "What has happened to my life?" And somewhere God is laughing. But he gave me what I didn't have. And that makes me a fuller person. I'm certain that there is some kind of weaving going on in our lives, that people we meet and experiences we have are not standalone types of experiences. Somehow, it all matters. It adds up to the story of not just one life, but life itself. That being part of a small group of people who get together regularly is a very strong thread to weave into your life. I'm certain that we were created for relationship with each other and the earth, and that when Jessica McGee comes up here and tells us the story of plastic straws and little sea turtles, it has impact because I heard it here in my community, and I don't know her. I'm still connected to her. And now I love straws. I don't like cold. I like cold water. I don't like ice. It makes my teeth hurt. I love straws. I do not love hand washing anything. And because of Jessica McGee, who I do not even know, who spoke in my community, I now own reusable straws and am no longer buying disposable ones. And Kelly, too, she's got something to do with that. Yeah. I'm certain that my family is hoping for some mention of zombies in this sermon because Halloween is coming up and they think that would be pretty cool. I'm certain that I matter in the lives of others, even on the days when I struggle to remember that. And showing up matters. Showing up here in your community matters. I'm certain that we all have a story to tell, and thank you for listening to mine. forgot all the great slides and biblical references. You just need to look at Steve's stuff from last week, because that's it. His was good. He was all prepared.
Okay, so I have a dilemma here. So my dilemma is that it's 10:10, and this is 30 minutes long. And I finished my first draft at 4 a.m. today, so I don't have, like, command of it to edit it down on the fly. So I think I'll just say, leave when you need to leave. last week, Steve opened the series by talking about how life and faith are full of uncertainty, but church subculture is often strongly oriented towards certainty. Clearly defined boundaries, no-fly zones, lists of things to believe. And when the experience of uncertainty collides with the culture that shuns it, two common responses are, one, to retrench, dig in, deny that there's a place for uncertainty in life or faith. Or, two, cut ties, separate from your faith, tradition, and community, maybe even grab a torch and seek to burn it all down. And there's probably something to be said for each of those options, but Steve presented a third way to embrace uncertainty. He said that doubt is a component of faith and that the Bible speaks not of intellectual certainty but of an experiential assurance based on who God is, not what we know. I thought that was well said and broadly helpful for many people, but at the same time it left me with the question, assurance based on who God is. What if who God is part of what has fallen apart for me? What if I have no idea anymore who God is, or if he is, or she is, or it is? What if my experience is what is destroying my assurance about God and has been doing so for many years? What then? What would it mean for me to embrace uncertainty in the context of faith? This morning I'm going to tell you something of my journey into and out of faith and how I'm beginning to find a new relationship to faith in the midst of uncertainty. I struggled with how to talk about this because everyone's backgrounds are different and I despaired of being able to speak intelligibly about this to a diverse audience in a short span of time, or maybe not so short. But I was reminded of Henry Nouwen's assertion that what is most personal is also most universal. What is most deeply, unguardedly, and even tenderly true in me touches something fundamentally human, and so is likely to resonate with something correspondingly true in you. So armed with that encouragement, even though it didn't feel at all believable while I was writing this, nevertheless, as an act of faith, here's my story. I was raised in a Taiwanese immigrant home, first in the Bay Area and then in St. Louis. My parents were wicked smart and worked incredibly hard, as immigrants do, and passed on to me a set of traits and values, zeal and idealism, and a conservative practicality, careful thinking and empiricism, responsibility and an emphasis on one's obligations. They also raised me an atheist with little cultural exposure to Christianity. Occasionally we'd put up a perfunctory, sad little Christmas tree, but I didn't understand Christmas carols, have any idea what round yon virgin mother and child could mean. I have great respect and deep gratitude for my parents today, but it's accurate to say that my childhood home environment was severe, emotionally cold, and socially isolated.
In high school in the mid-80s, I fell in with some kids who were Christians and super high-quality people. One of them, Stephen, was a pastor's kid whose family impressed me so much. They turned their garage into a playroom for the neighborhood kids, and there was usually someone risky living with them medium to long-term who might, you know, assault them from time to time, to which they would respond by serving them lunch. I spent a fair amount of time at Stephen's house playing D&D or talking about apologetics, and while I was there, I witnessed a style of parental discipline that was stern and loving, serious and yet not fearsome. It was so foreign to me that it was difficult for me to understand, and I found it powerfully attractive. Largely on the strength of their example of love, I converted in 1986, finding in Christianity a system and a structure that could explain my life, an authority that would direct it, a community that offered a warm, loving home and a way of life to emulate. Though my conversion was largely emotionally driven, my faith was, from the beginning, blended with scientific rationalism. God was real like photons were real, or like fluid mechanics was real, like the incompressible Navier-Stokes equations are real. Susceptible of some easy initial understanding, but complex enough to support centuries of exploration with inscrutable aspects and surprising implications, but still useful to explain and guide. For 15 to 20 years, my faith worked. While there were seasons of doubt and uncertainty, and over time, faith required increasing nuance, through it all, I saw myself as guided by God and loved by Him. I remained in orbit around a central confidence that God is personal and relational, that He knows me and loves me and is concerned with my life, that He communicates with and responds to me, that He superintends or at least intervenes in all things for good, that history is on course toward its good end, that we have been entrusted with the truth, and we are empowered by the Spirit to live out God's kingdom on earth. And this confidence inspired and enabled acts of love, service, generosity, and risk-taking that to this day I respect. It sustained me through college and grad school and through family crises. It led me to the mission field and to seminary. It helped me to genuinely and freely love people who had hurt me, to see people I didn't like as bearers of God's image and beautiful. It spawned in me a generous honesty. It provided healthy communities of faith in which to grow and belong. It called forth and nurtured the best parts of me. Then around 10, 15 years ago, I started to feel increasing dissonance, and that the center of my faith was not holding. Less of my experience lined up with the models my faith provided me, how prayer was supposed to work, how marriage was supposed to work, how doing engineering with Jesus was supposed to work, how my own sanctification was supposed to work. Here's a stylized example. "I am with you always to the end of the age" was originally and naively a promise of God's caring presence. But what if it's been 5 years since I've felt God is with me? Well, it doesn't mean you will feel or know His presence. It means that in some more fundamental way than your experience, He's with you and caring for you. Okay, and what if awful shit keeps happening? Well, His care for you may not meet any particular experiential standard, but everything that happens is still for good. Okay, but this is clearly not good. Okay, well, it's good for shaping who you are to bring God glory. Okay, but I actually seem to be getting worse in relevant ways. Well, you can't see the ways in which this glorifies God in the long run. I kept falling through the floor into deeper and deeper sub-basements until I wondered, do any of these floors actually provide support? If truths about life, the universe, and everything need to be continually explained further and further away from actual experience, they stop seeming to be truths about life, the universe, or anything, and more like head games and wishful thinking. This went on for several years of holding fast to faith against the dissonance of my experience until holding on started to feel less like loyalty and faithfulness and more like dishonesty and cowardice. So a couple of years ago, I let go. My experience of faith in the first half of life was not so much one of certainty about God per se, but of accessing God within an objectively true, empirically warranted framework. And I lost that sense of warrant, and so I lost the framework, and so I lost access to the meaning, direction, and comfort that I received from God, which kind of sucked. Most of the time I felt lonely, sad, homeless, and pathetic. I felt myself shifting away from generosity toward self-protectiveness. I was more afraid of being hurt and less resilient, both relationally and professionally. My tolerance for risk and ambiguity at work visibly suffered. I had less hope for change in my relationships, particularly in my marriage, but also a depressed, smaller sense of what was possible for our boys. I liked myself less. Okay, so that's a ton of navel-gazy negativity for a sermon, and I apologize for that, but I wanted to establish that I needed a new framework, a new model of faith, and I'm happy to report that I found one. I got input here from a number of sources, not least of which was our own formation community, a 2-year spiritual formation, spiritual direction journey that our church goes through in waves. I guess we're on wave 5 now. Monica and I went through it in 2016, 2017, and I just loved it. Tools like the breath prayer and centering prayer exercises, and especially the group spiritual direction, were super valuable to me, but I'm going to focus today on how I was helped by the liturgists. I discovered the liturgists in 2015. Their tagline was exploring topics through the science, through the lenses of science, art, and faith, but really there were a couple of guys, Science Mike and Michael Gunger, who lost their faith, lost God and their faith communities, and got super lonely. And so they built a space where they could feel at home and invite other spiritual misfits and exiles. They created a handful of beautiful liturgies and guided meditations, but are best known for the Liturgist podcast. Episodes 6 and 7 from season 1 of that podcast, called Lost and Found, are still the most important thing I've heard easily in the last 5 years. It's 2 hours of them describing in beautiful, intimate, deeply instructive conversation how they lost their faith and, at least in Science Mike's case, how he found God again. I felt so utterly at home in that conversation. I've listened to it at least 20 times. They held a two-day event in Atlanta called Belong, and I went on something of a pilgrimage there, where they talked about how our understanding of everything evolves, including God. And so if you find belief in God ridiculous, maybe your idea of God just needs to evolve. No big deal. And they introduced me to Tanya Lerman and Andrew Newberg. From Andrew Newberg and his book, How God Changes Your Brain, they taught on the neurophysiology of belief, how humans have a neurological bias toward belief in God, and that there are 2 dominant neurological models of God across cultures. 1, God is angry and judgmental. Call this for shorthand the Old Testament God. Believers whose fundamental God concept is primarily angry have a higher state of limbic system arousal, i.e. amygdala activation. The amygdala is responsible for initiating your stress response or your fight or flight response. They are, as a population, more xenophobic and have a hard time forgiving themselves. At the same time, they're better at impulse control and behavior regulation, so there's always an upside. 2, the other dominant model is a God who is loving and compassionate. Call this for shorthand the New Testament God. Believers whose fundamental God concept is primarily loving have a thicker anterior cingulate cortex. The anterior cingulate cortex lies between your limbic system and your frontal lobe. It connects our emotions with our cognitive skills and supports emotional self-control. These believers, again, as a population, are more trusting and gracious with people who look or think differently from them. They also have a thicker prefrontal cortex and tend to have better focus. These differences are visible in fMRI scans and are supported by serious research. Okay, so I'm going to come back to that. Tanya Lerman's book, When God Talks Back, is an anthropological study of how adult converts to Christ learn to experience God in the context of church life. She's an atheist scholar who spent 4 years in the vineyard, going to weekly services and prayer meetings, joining a small group, and interviewing members. It's a remarkable book. She was making no statements about whether God was real or not. She took as a given that the experience of God was real, and then described anthropologically how Christians learn to hear God's voice, how we are trained and coached in imaginative practices that help us connect with God and experience God as real. Practices like disciplines of prayer and devotional Bible reading and charismatic experiences. Christians learn how to attend to certain parts of their mind in such a way that they experience those thoughts and feelings as originating outside themselves from God. She lovingly and carefully describes what she observed. And as I thought back over my own history of learning how to pray, how to hear from God and feel God's presence, her descriptions made sense. At one time, I was taught to be wary of such naturalistic descriptions of faith experiences, but these were actually stepping stones for me to move forward towards faith again. I said earlier that I needed a new model for faith, and I'm using this word in its somewhat scientific sense of a representation of a class of systems or phenomena which captures their behavior in significant ways. Models are by nature reductionistic and approximate, which is another way of saying that they are wrong, but accurate enough to be useful. What I came to realize was that I can move forward to embrace an inaccurate but still useful model of faith. I can move forward to embrace an inaccurate but still useful model of faith. So let me walk through this. Move forward. This is not me coming home to the faith I lost, to my faith of 20 years ago, which, among other things, tried to persuade others to believe as I did. I can't do that today because I have not recovered a sense that my beliefs about God are warranted or objectively true. I don't want to make too big a deal of that, and I am not saying that I think someone is wrong if they do so believe. I'm just quietly saying that I don't, at least not today. Inaccurate, that's the my beliefs aren't warranted part. I think I've covered that. Useful model. Maybe there really is a God, maybe there's not. But I have 86 billion neurons that want to believe in something. I need a meaning-making framework. One that I share with a community. And neuroscience tells me that a framework that is organized around a God who is loving and compassionate promotes empathy, emotional regulation, and focus. So I could try to invent or find a new God like that, a God of my anterior cingulate cortex. But I already have 30 plus years invested with God the Father, who so loved the world that he gave his only Son, and who fills us with his Holy Spirit. 30 plus years of being empowered, at least sometimes, to make difficult decisions because God was calling me to them.
I want to be that kind of person still. And the Christian faith gives me a structure to do that. Not primarily a belief structure, but a mental, emotional, decisional structure. A structure in which I can find comfort and meaning and self-respect. A structure that celebrates discipline and humility. A structure that lifts up for me the beauty of kindness and generosity. A structure that says that God loves the poor and the downtrodden. So maybe tone down your self-interest a bit. A structure that places demands on me and offers a high calling. A structure in which I can belong to and with others. So I'm embracing this model of faith, leaving behind the overconfidence and tribalism and the I'm right, you're wrong, but reclaiming verses about God's provision and protection and his empowering. I'm dwelling on the idea that God cares for me and loves me and created a good world for me to be in. I'm choosing to say yes when he invites me into risky opportunities to which my atheist self would say, no thanks. These practices, per Tanya Lerman, are helping me to reconstruct my neurological experience of God. These practices are acts of faith, a faith which is not warranted, but which I embrace nonetheless. So to close, how does a son of Taiwanese immigrants, whose parents taught him almost above all else to think carefully and responsibly, how do I utter that last sentence, that I am embracing a faith that is not warranted? So I have some precedent for this, two from work and then one from a children's book. At Amazon, from business, maybe not work. At Amazon, one of their phrases is disagree and commit. Disagree and commit. Have strong, well-thought-out opinions and debate them vigorously. But when debate ends and the organization makes a decision, everyone commits, even those who still disagree, because it's not about them anymore. It's about where the organization's going. And I may have wrinkled my nose at this as a younger man, but after 15 years of corporate product development engineering, I totally get this. You commit earnestly and work hard to support something you do not believe in, say the direction of a particular project, because you believe something bigger, that you're part of the larger effort of the organization. Likewise, at Palo Alto's Institute for the Future, they talk about having strong opinions weakly held. The problem with weak opinions is that people don't put the energy into developing, testing, and acting on them that is required. But if we're too convinced of those opinions, if we hold them too strongly, we're unable to receive contradictory input, even if it's available and relevant. So in this sense, my faith is like a strong opinion not held at all. But most of all, my example and inspiration here is Puddle Glum. I think I've had four enduring heroes in my life. Mr. Spock, Mr. Rogers, Samwise Gamgee, and Puddle Glum. Puddle Glum was a character in C.S. Lewis's The Silver Chair, which was the fourth book in the Narnia series. Physically, Puddle Glum was like a cross between a frog and a scarecrow, temperamentally more of a mashup between Martin Freeman's Bilbo and Eeyore. Eternally pessimistic, he was also loyal, dignified, and indomitable. In the climactic scene of the book, when the Queen of Underland has enchanted Jill, Eustace, Prince Rillian, and Puddle Glum into believing that Narnia and all the lands above ground don't exist, Puddle Glum says these wonderful words. Suppose we have only dreamed up all those things, trees and grass and sun and moon and stars and Aslan himself. Suppose we have. Then all I can say is that in that case, the made-up things seem a good deal more important than the real ones. Suppose this black pit of a kingdom of yours is the only world. Well, it strikes me as a pretty poor one. And that's a funny thing when you come to think of it. We're just babies making up a game, if you're right. But four babies playing a game can make a play world which licks your real world hollow. That's why I'm going to stand by the play world. I'm on Aslan's side, even if there isn't any Aslan to lead it. I'm going to live as like a Narnian as I can, even if there isn't any Narnia. So thanking you kindly for our supper, if these two gentlemen and the young lady are ready, we're leaving your court at once and setting out in the dark to spend our lives looking for overland. Not that our lives will be very long, I should think, but that's a small loss if the world's as dull a place as you say. I am on Jesus' side, even if there isn't any Jesus to follow. I'm going to live as like a Christian as I can, even if there isn't any Christ. A fucking man.